Hello, I'm Brian.
I'm Caroline.
I'm Claire.
And this is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
Podcast.
Welcome to the podcast and welcome back to the podcast if you're a regular listener. So we're recording on Friday, 25th September, at the end of a week of a lot of changes in the UK. We've been told basically to work from home if you can, reversing the previous policy. Pubs are closing at 10 and we've got the NHS contact tracing app. Big week for us or just more of the same? Anyone downloaded the app?
I downloaded it the night before it actually launched because I'm just such an early adopter and I love tech so much. I just couldn't help myself. But also, no, someone just said, oh, you can download it now, like if you want to get ahead of the crowd. You didn't know if it was going to be something that if everyone tried to download at once, would it fall over? So I just thought I'd give it a go. But yeah, so far so good. I'm in a medium risk area for COVID and I've had no alerts that anyone who's come into close contact with me has got the virus. So yeah, I'm loving its work at the minute.
So far so good.
Mm-hmm.
I've not downloaded it yet. I was going to wait until I would actually be maybe on public transport or in a crowd or something like that.
It seems like the most likely place, doesn't it, to catch anything?
I mean, the only implication for me is I was going back to the office every now and again. I was planning to go back maybe a couple of times a month, but it seems like we're being discouraged now from doing that. And pret-a-manger can just go to the wall, sadly.
It's difficult, isn't it? The balancing act.
It is. And thankfully, none of us have to make the big decisions on it. And Christmas as well. We were speaking about this before we started recording. It's going to have implications for that. And I suppose there is a 6 months thing. That was a bit of a shocker for a lot of people, I think, when Boris Johnson said, and we're going to do this for 6 months.
I think because first time around with lockdown, there wasn't a prescribed set amount of time necessarily. Was it like something like, oh, this will be in place for 3 weeks, and then it got extended, and then it kind of got a gradual, kind of more subtle extension, and then bits of it started rolling back a bit. So yeah, I think the fact is like, right, guys, you've been in this for like 6 months already. We're going to have another 6 months. It is quite a hard thing to hear. It might not even be a hard deadline. We don't know where we're going to be with, you know, vaccines and contact tracing and everything by then. So yeah, it's a bit of a hard one to get your head around.
Anyway, we are where we are. And I suppose it's maybe lockdown 2.0 gives you the chance to revisit those impossible dreams that you had at the beginning about learning to become a concert pianist or a coder, Python. All that stuff. Maybe revisit some of that stuff with renewed gusto.
Nah, I got really into gardening and now we're going into a bit of a fallow period from a gardening perspective. So I'm just going to have to put all that on hold till the spring again. So yeah, I think I'm just going to wallow in the lockdown version 2.
Hibernate.
Yeah, hibernate. Perfect. Okay.
Where we're heading in this particular episode of the podcast, top line stuff. Claire, you're still very much in the midst of our own events and you're going to talk about yesterday's workshop.
Yes, I am. So in the lead up to the event on the 1st of October, we've been doing workshops each week, which aim to sort of give people a takeaway that they can go and implement either in their own lives or in their company. And the most recent one was about making the tech workplace more inclusive for Black colleagues and employees. So I'm going to talk a bit about that.
And I came along to that one as a lurker. So
yeah, I'm interested to see what you thought.
Caroline, you've got a nice case study for us with a Gen Z twist.
Yeah, it's about an app, a parentally controlled debit card app for 6 to 18-year-olds, which helps them manage their money. So I had a chat with the COO and CTO behind that this week. And yeah, it was just a really interesting chat about how their technology is helping kids sort of get educated on money management and financial planning, but in quite a subtle way. So yeah, I enjoyed it.
Interesting, actually. Mm-hmm. More on that in a little bit. I've got a case study as well, and also a CIO interview to talk about. This is with Julie Berry at the accountancy firm Safri Champness, and it's mainly about their implementation of a cloud-based document management system. So real practical kind of IT director type stuff. And more about that towards the end of the podcast. So Claire, the workshop yesterday.
Yeah, I hope I described this properly because it can be quite difficult to make sure that you use the right wording to describe different companies and what they're trying to achieve and stuff like that. But the workshop was run by the Tech Talent Charter, which is, I guess, a collective. It's a bit difficult to describe. So basically, the Tech Talent Charter has a bunch of signatories who all sign up and then commit to looking at their internal sort of like diversity and inclusion, and then doing things like working with local communities and sharing best practice. And they have an open playbook that people can look at, and it sort of describes some of those best practices and ways to include in improve diversity and inclusion in an organization. And the workshop that they ran as part of our diversity and inclusion event, it featured a bunch of people who took part in a Tech Talent Charter hackathon and then developed an education and allyship roadmap, which I think is meant to help organizations be more inclusive and open for Black employees. That's how I understood it. So the workshop had a panel which was made up of the people who made that education and allyship roadmap, talking about the importance of inclusion for Black employees and how to approach that. So Debbie Forster, who's the CEO of the Tech Talent Charter, was trying to ask some of the difficult questions that organizations and people find quite difficult to ask, and then get the panel to answer them as best they could. So one of the questions was, if a company has just become woke and it wants to move forward, what are the current barriers in place for being more inclusive, and how do you overcome them? Basically, one of the things that was highlighted is that unless you're part of an underrepresented group, you never quite know what it's like to be part of one of those underrepresented groups.
Absolutely, Came across really strongly.
So I think one of the panel members was saying something along the lines of, even if you're a woman in tech and you know what it's like to be in a minority in a white male dominated environment, you still don't know what it's like to be a Black person in tech because you don't have that same experience. And to, be aware of that if you're trying to be an ally, like being aware of the privilege. And I'm going to write it up into a blog post, so that people have more insight into what was spoken about. But halfway through the workshop, we got split into breakout rooms, or at least some of the other people did. And I wondered what that was like because I didn't get to take part in a breakout.
I did.
So what was it like?
There was four of us in our room, all four of us white. The main kind of thing that came out of ours, if I recall correctly, was that it's important to understand that the BAME community is not homogenous. So that came out of ours. And in the sort of plenary that followed, one of the panelists, and bear with me while I remember who it was Marika B. She said, I think partly in response to that, don't be afraid to say black.
That was one of the messages that I took away because, as Debbie Forster said in response to that comment, sometimes you don't want to say the wrong thing.
She
But
did remember saying that, yeah.
you have to, I think she said, you have to accept and be willing to be uncomfortable and risk getting it wrong for the sake of advancement, basically.
Yeah, risk getting it wrong. And what one of the things that occurred to me was, this is very early days. So we touch two industries really, don't we? We've got publishing, which we do, and we also cover the tech industry. And publishing and media is very white, generally, and it's just not been, in my view, it's not been even examined or thought about until very recently, like how those of us who have jobs in this industry have these jobs, but there are other people who don't. So how did that come about? I think there's a lot of, big thinking to be done. And again, one of the things that I took from the workshop was networks, as you were saying, Claire, about barriers. That's how Debbie opened it up, wasn't it? She was asking about what kind of barriers are there and It's just that there are no networks for a lot of Black people working in industries like ours.
Yeah, and that was what some of the panelists were saying as well, that working on your network can be really important. A lot of the time in companies, you can be promoted because of who you know. Working on opening up your networks to people who might not typically be in your network could help that.
Gori said, this was Gori Yahaya. He said something that really struck me. He said, we're all very familiar with this phrase, it's the best person for the job that gets it. And that had a really strong resonance with all the other panelists. They all just said, yeah, we've heard that so many times. And we know that progression is not based on merit. All these other social things that have happened before to create the situation, going back in history and the kind of society that we live in.
Yeah, even down to the groups of people that are targeted to be considered for roles won't include different types of people because of how we got to this point.
Well, this in particular is a big sort of weighty issues that employers need to be getting on top of. Do you think there is, like for some companies, do they sort of feel like, okay, this is something they feel like they can publicly start acknowledging, or is by doing so, is it something that, oh, you know, will this reflect badly on us that we're not already there, if you see what I mean? Do you think this, is there a right or wrong time to be tackling this, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
I think there was talk that you want to see action as well as just, you know, like a statement. Like a lot of companies released a statement saying that they were behind Black Lives Matter and stuff like that. But then if you actually dig down into it, they're not particularly doing anything. So I don't think it's about whether or not it's the right time to be saying something. It's always the right time to be doing something. And it's much better to do it rather than just say. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, no, it definitely does. But it's just this element of, like, do you think companies be willing to sort of put their hands up and say, look, we're not doing a good job on this at the moment? Or is it kind of, oh, let's just kind of, we'll make our statements about Black Lives Matter and just hope no one really holds us under any scrutiny?
I think it's better to be authentic about it. You know, say we've not done well up until this point and we want to do better and we're taking it upon ourselves to educate ourselves and make things better. I think it's always better to do that than to just sort of hope no one notices.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the gender pay gap, which, you know, was what the other workshop was about. Companies with a certain number of employees had to publish their gender pay gap, regardless of whether they've been working on it or not. You're going to get found out anyway.
I think reverse mentoring was mentioned, and maybe just making sure that Black employees do get a mentor. If you're going to have a mentorship program, then, you know, try to help them build up networks through that.
Yeah, and then the reverse mentoring aspect of that, you know, with the employee making those higher up in an organization aware of what it feels like to be in their position as well. So it's not just, you know, like, oh, I'll pull you up the ladder behind me. It's also like, well, no, look at what it's like to be in my position and how you can help other people like me as well.
And generally be brave. That was one of the themes, wasn't it, Claire? I think there was a couple of people talked about bravery.
That was the sort of closing message, wasn't it? You know, like to be brave and to move forward. And, you know, you might be scared of getting things wrong, but it's better to be doing something positive.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought Debbie made those points really well in conclusion. This is the last workshop before the big event next week.
It is. After the event next week, or when the podcast comes out this week on the 1st of October, I'll talk about that. But there is another workshop that was before the two that I've spoken about on the podcast that I'll fill you in on after that as well.
Okay.
That one was about neurodiversity.
Okay.
But we weren't recording the podcast when it was run, so I didn't get a chance to talk about it yet. Next week, the event, and I'll talk about that. And then the week after, a little bit of a backwards look at the first workshop.
Cool. And Caroline, you're now going to take us into case study territory.
Yeah, case studies. So, one of the universal qualities that all good journalists need to have is a natural inbuilt curiosity that makes you want to get to the bottom of things or find out more about the people we encounter and the work they do. So in the field of technology journalism, that means that we often end up at Computer Weekly quizzing CIOs, CTOs, or assorted other senior IT leaders about their IT strategies and how that all aligns with achieving their business goals. Or sometimes we talk to them about like maybe a one-off project as well that they want to talk to us about that feeds into all of that as well. But those conversations are sort of genuinely some of my favourite types of stories to do at Computer Weekly, because like all journalists, I am naturally curious, or some might say nosy. So yeah, I love sort of getting into the thick of all those things. But every so often when you do have those conversations, the best ones are when it brings to your attention a company or an initiative that you've never come across before. But as you're hearing about it, you're sitting there thinking, oh, that's a good idea. Like, I can totally see why that needs to exist in the world. But I'm not going to lie, sometimes some of those conversations when, like, say you're in the thick of a call or an interview, you're just sitting there thinking completely the opposite. But very much in the that's a good idea is the company I spoke to this week called GoHenry, who are the provider of a parentally controlled prepaid debit card service, which is aimed at 6 to 18 year olds. How it works is that parents get a mobile app, which they use to transfer money onto their kids' debit cards. And they can use it to distribute pocket money in a cashless way to these debit cards. Or, you know, if they complete chores around the house, you know, they can pay the money directly onto their debit cards. And then the kids can go out and spend their money however they see fit. I don't really know what kids spend their money on these days in shops. My day is all penny sweets and heading to Woolworths for CD singles. So
penny sweets. I miss penny sweets. I really do. And these days, Pick and Mix is extortionately expensive. You can't get anything for a penny anymore.
No, I think that's why they've just quietly gone away from that branding. You know, the whole penny sweets thing. Just like, not with inflation. It doesn't exist. So on the one hand, it makes it more convenient for parents because, as the company's COO, Louise Hill, was telling me this week during our chat, they're scrambling around trying to find cash in the house, you know, to give to kids as pocket money is actually quite difficult these days. She sort of said, you know, you either have sort of 3 pence on you or you have a £20 note, and then it's like, oh, am I going to give my child a £20 note? I'm going to give them 3 pence. That seems a bit harsh. So it's that kind of thing, you know, the convenience for parents. But also it's this the thing. You know, we're living in a society now and an economy that is increasingly digital. It's online, contactless transactions are the norm. So we don't always have cash on us that we can readily give out to other people. But at the same time, you know, kids are witnessing their parents go into shops, use contactless, you know, pay for things online, stuff like that. So why do we expect kids to one step behind and still relying on cash?
So kids get the card and then that card works in a shop like any other debit card would.
Yeah, it's a Visa card, so wherever they accept Visa, your child can go and spend their money. And but it's, you know, in terms of safeguards and stuff like that, it is prepaid, so they can only spend obviously the amount that their parent or guardian has added onto the card. So, you know, there's no risk of the children spiraling into debt or getting overdrawn or anything like that. That would be a terrible outcome for a store, wouldn't it? Yeah, it's sort of letting kids use money in the same way that they see their adults and role models using money as well. Yeah, so kids see their parents paying for goods in this way, and then they can appreciate, you know, this is how the world of e-commerce works now. So does it make sense to keep giving them cold hard cash to use, you know, particularly in the COVID economy where we're all being discouraged from using cash as well, like sending the kids into shops, like, you know, you have to pay with cash. It does seem particularly cruel.
Yeah, that's good for the development of, you know, like basic digital skills as well. When you keep hearing about all of these adults that don't have digital skills to survive in the world, but if you're equipping kids with, you know, like that those sort of habits early on, then they're more likely to get on in the future.
Well, yeah, there's like I said, it's kind of one of that in particular is like another reason why I was having this conversation with them. I was like, this just seems like such a good idea, because there's a danger as well with in the, you know, where online transactions are concerned, it might be difficult for kids to sort of gain an appreciation of what money is and how it works if you're never seeing anything kind of physical change hands. So, like, you know, we've all seen those stories online, you know, where, you know, a child has, you know, clicked, made a few in-app purchases within a game or whatever, and then their parents are bankrupt and having to sell the house to like, to pay back the debt or whatever. Because, you know, the kids, you know, in those instances don't fully appreciate that every time they click on that, you know, the thing in the game, the in-app purchase button, but that is real money that is being spent. And there is a, you know, someone who is going to have to pick up the bill for that later down the line. So it's kind of sort of making sort of how money's spent and stuff like that sort of more transparent by making the kids accountable by saying, like, if you want to buy this, like, if you want to buy this thing, or whatever it is, you have to use your own debit card to pay for it. And once your money's run out, that's the end of it. It's kind of teaching them sort of money management, like Claire said.
In sort of the same way that you used to get when you got given cash pocket money, when it's gone, it's gone.
Yeah.
But teaching them, you know, like the modern sort of making that association between physical cash, because now it's all digital, you don't see it being spent. But if you have to be aware, you know, and, you know, like aware of the maths around it as well. Every time you tap, that costs X amount and you have to keep track in your brain of how much money you've got.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's just showing kids like the sort of principles of like budgeting in a way that I feel like, you know, isn't forcing it down their throats, if you know what I mean. It's sort of just, you know, this is it. Here's your card. There's a set amount of money on it. Once it's gone, it's gone. If you want to earn more money, you can do more work around the house, or you have to wait until pocket money day, or which when they grow up will be payday. So you know, it's kind of getting them into those habits now when they're young. Like I said, the COO who I spoke to, Louise Hill, she sort of said, you know, money management so that is such an important and practical life skill that, you know, that was another big part of like why they wanted to sort of launch the app in the first place. And yeah, and it is being taught to them in a way that is in step with how society is operating at the moment. And also how she was saying kids already know how to operate. So, you know, Generation Z are, you know, digital natives, as we've talked about previously on the podcast. But they're also, she said, sort of cashless natives as well, because, you know, they are used to growing up online and just, oh, purchase button here, click this, do that. They're just, this is the society they've grown up in. And a lot of the transactions they take part in every day, you know, involve money, but not necessarily in physical form. So why would you teach them money management in that way anymore? It was a really, really interesting chat. Like I said, and that's just touched upon like sort of just the principles of what the company is and what they do. Really good idea. But and obviously lots of other people think that as well. They were saying that they've got, as of March this year, they've got 1 million active users who are sort of using the app and you know, people signed up to use it. Because, like I said, other people get what they're trying to do. So the reason I was talking to them was because to accommodate all the growth they've seen, 3 years ago, they migrated over to the Google Cloud platform using Rackspace for hosting, but on a smaller scale. And they just said, you know, the take-up of the service meant that the more people they added to it, the more service they needed. And they just thought, right, we've got to go to the cloud because it's scalable, expandable, and we can just grow as far as we need to. So that's going to be the bread and butter of the actual case study, which is in the throes of being written up at the moment. But like I said, it's just, like I said, it's nice when you sit down with someone, have a chat with them and you find out about a company who aren't necessarily on your radar. And like I say, you can just think, okay, I can see exactly what the value of this is and, you know, sort of the use cases for it and yeah, how it's going to benefit people in the future.
Nice.
So children are no longer stuffing piggy banks with notes and coins and things.
Nope, because they're too hard to convert into Fortnite V-Bucks and FIFA coins is what I reckon. So yeah, there's no point doing that anymore.
So from one kind of cloudy case study to another, mine is a case study about a cloud-based document management system. Or the sexiest, the sexiest of things, not even in IT, but you know, nevertheless very vital. So I did an interview. I'm not going to say when the interview was because it has taken me a while to write this up. But it was with a lady called Julie Berry, who is IT partner at Safri Champness, which is an accountancy firm. So she's effectively CIO, although that's not her actual job title. And Julie's worked in professional services in IT for 25 plus years, I mean, quite a long time. Previously law firms, one particular law firm where she was for quite a long time, Reynolds Porter Chamberlain, but she moved to this accountancy firm, Saffrey Chapman, about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago now. She also has something like 25 years of experience of document management, which is very important in professional services because lawyers and accountants and people like that generate documents like breathing. You know, they just all day, every day generating documents in much the same way as we, you know, generate stories. So yes, but she's made this move over to accountancy. Saffrey Champness is, it's not really one of the bigger accountancy firms like PricewaterhouseCoopers or Deloitte or KPMG, but it's number 12 in the UK, founded in 1855 in the city. She and her team implemented a document management system, which is cloud-based, called NetDocuments. Did that in 2019. Started doing it in March, finished in November, which is a very important time for accountancy firms because that's when people start doing their tax returns and stuff like that. So before, they didn't really have a document management system as such. They kind of created an organic one using their shared drives, Outlook, directories, et cetera. They've got, by the way, about 600 accountants and about 200 support staff. So that's the scale of the workforce in the UK. And the IT team consists of 12 people, more or less. NetDocuments, as the name would suggest, it's one of that really early generation of cloud companies like NetSuite. So this is before software as a service. This is before the rise of the hyperscalers like AWS, GCP and Azure and so on. So it wasn't called software as a service in the early 2000s. There were a slew of companies that were called Net something. And NetDocuments is one of those, founded in Utah. Very much a cloud from the ground up kind of company. So the application, and Julie said this, you can tell that their stuff is, it's always been in the cloud. It's designed in that way in the first place. And she was saying there's a security aspect and also the collaboration aspect of NetDocuments that they find useful, both across the firm and with our clients. And it integrates really well with their email system, which is Outlook. That's very important because that's the way people work. She made an interesting observation about like the whole concept of you don't have to save your document in a folder was a really alien concept for the accountants and the other support staff. So the idea that you know the system will do that for you is something that they found quite kind of strange in a way. And they had to do training to kind of get people's heads around the way the software would work. Beyond this particular piece of software, although I should say that she said, although they'd implemented a document management system, by doing that, that had shone a light on various working practices and processes that were kind of good enough, more or less effective, but not efficient enough. So it was kind of there was a kind of change management aspect to it. And also from the point of view of, this is very important for our kind of readers, is that from the point of view of her team, she just kept saying, well, look, I don't want them doing transactional stuff. I want them to be advisors to the business and adding value to the business. She's got a really nice quote. She said that, I'm a great believer in cloud first. None of us gets business strategic benefits from having servers in a comms room. It just doesn't provide agility. So that whole kind of philosophy of you abstract as much of that old IT infrastructure stuff that you used to do, move that away, and then people can focus on the higher value stuff and adding value to the business. I mean, we hear this all the time as like advice, but actually to see it being implemented in a company like this, which is, you know, important, been around for a while, fair number of staff, but it's not, you know, one of the kind of absolute top firms. talked about a bunch of stuff beyond that. I thought it was very interesting. She told me that they've got a virtual CISO. So they're not really big enough to have their own chief security officer. So they engage a company called Sapio, who provide them with a virtual chief security officer, which I thought was quite a neat way of dealing with that. Because obviously security for an accountancy firm is just very, very, very important. We spoke about the reasons for her specific technology choice, and the detail of that is in the story itself, to which we'll have a link in the summary article. So I won't go into that here. We talked about the difference between lawyers and accountants. I find this stuff really interesting because professional services is something that we do really well. Because forever, like, the government goes on about, oh, after Brexit, we'll lead the world with our magnificent AI and tech industry. And okay, that's nice, and we've got a decent shot at that. But we've been, as the UK, and especially as London, to some extent, maybe Glasgow and Edinburgh and Manchester, but especially the City of London, we've been doing professional services and financial services on an international scale for a very long time. It is actually something we're very good at. So yeah, I quite like talking to services companies, because it is actually something that we do really well. One thing I really wanted to pull out was the pandemic. She said that if they hadn't implemented this cloud-based document management system in 2019, they would have really struggled. So she said that she had indeed predicted the pandemic, and that's why she put it in. Another thing that, I'll close up on this quite soon, but another thing that vis-a-vis the pandemic that I thought was very interesting that she said was to do with young workers, because professional services firms like accountancy and law and management consultancy and stuff, they always have this kind of cohort of young trainees who come in, become fully fledged accountants or solicitors, or they learn how to be strategy consultants or whatever, and then they maybe move on, or they move to a client or something like that. So they always have a kind of group of, very young workers, professional workers, graduates in their early 20s. And she was saying that, in her view, that they prefer a bit of being in the office, a bit of blended working, because they're with their peers and they learn stuff from their kind of seniors on the job. I thought that was interesting. Because, there's a lot of firms that have that profile. And she had this phrase, office in a rucksack. That's one of her goals, is you carry your office around in a rucksack. But it was a really nice chat, a really good conversation. I really enjoyed talking to Julie. She's just a really down-to-earth IT director, kind of doing some of the stuff that we often talk about.
The whole, you could carry your work around with you, and wherever you plop down, that's where your office is. Mm-hmm. Seems to be the new goal, the new thing to work towards, doesn't it?
It does, and I suppose we're doing that, and everyone's doing it.
Mm.
I think she said, like, their young trainees are really, not really cool about that, but they still want to be in the office and see their mates. And a lot of them are, like some of our own staff, they're living in London. They're maybe not being that well paid at the moment. They're in shared accommodation, rubbish Wi-Fi. However, it's been a positive experience for all of their staff, the whole working from home thing, partly thanks to this cloud-based document management system. So, well, hey.
Cloud saves the day again.
We know that a big consumer of time for Claire next week is going to be our big event, the Diversity in Tech 2020 event. So that's, I guess, the main thing on your agenda for next week, Claire.
Yes, it is. It has been taking up a lot of my time. And I think I said last week, I love doing it and it's one of the best things about my job, but it takes a lot of time and effort to pull together.
And well worth it.
Definitely.
You also take over the issue for that week. The 6th of October issue is...
I get is an issue a year, yeah.
More clear.
Yeah.
What's next week for you, Caroline?
Hopefully catching up on my case studies myself, getting to write some of those up. But next week we do have, I think it's the start of the Google Cloud conference, the EMEA version. So I've got a couple of things to be, conference sessions to be sitting through in those remotely. And then, yeah, whatever else the news cycle decides to chuck at me over the course of the week, I'll get stuck into that as well.
Next week for me is the kind of the beginning of the extended Oracle Open World.
Mm.
This week I interviewed Steve Miranda, who runs cloud applications business globally for Oracle. I can't say what he told me because it's all under embargo until he gives his keynote next week. But yeah, that will be taking up some of my time and doing it, as we spoke about last week, remotely and not actually in San Francisco or Vegas, actually. They had shifted their conference to Vegas. Well, we will, as usual, provide links to all the stuff that we've discussed today, the summary article for the podcast and for other relevant stuff. And you can read that on computerweekly.com. And you can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Sadly, that's all we've got time for this week. Just remains for me to say, as ever, thank you to Caroline.
You're welcome.
Thank you to Claire.
Anytime.
And thanks very much to you, listener, for listening. Stay safe. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.